Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It is still the beginning of the fire season, and 5 million acres have already burned across California, Oregon, and Washington. According to the Los Angeles Times, fires are burning more populated areas and damage is increasing. Climate scientists say dry air, droughts, and record heat are exacerbating the fires. Fire officials blame everything from lightning storms, land and forest management, development in fire-prone areas, and fire suppression. Prior to the colonization of the West, indigenous tribes burned around 4.5 million acres a year in California. So what will it take to change the way fires are managed in the years to come? Joining us are two guests. Don Hankins is a pyrogeographer and professor of geography and planning at California State University at Chico. He is a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. Hi, Don. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Dr. Timothy Inglesby is Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, an organization that promotes safe ecological fire management, working with fire instead of fighting against fire. Dr. Inglesby started his fire career as a wildland firefighter for the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service. He is a certified senior wildland fire ecologist. Hi, Timothy. Thank you so much for joining us. Do we have Timothy? All right, we'll connect with him in a few minutes. Don, I want to ask you just a simple question. Given that this is still sort of at the beginning of the fire season, if we continue down this path, what do you think is to come in the next couple of months? How much worse can it get?
Well, that's the big unknown, right? I think that I definitely have to have a long-term mindset. You know, we're in it for the long haul. And I wouldn't rule out anything further than what we've been expecting or seeing currently. That's something that I think is really distraughtening to hear. But, you know, I think that this could be a really bad season. And I think the example of that would be to look to what Australia experienced in the southeastern areas of Australia this past season as an example of what we might be expecting further.
And Tim, are you back with us?
Yes, somehow.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you so much. What are your thoughts if we continue down this path? How much worse can it get in the coming months?
I believe coming months. How about coming years or generations? The real burning issue of our time, in my opinion, is burning fossil fuels and human-driven climate change. And unless we get a handle on that, I just don't know what we can do to address, you know, the annual crisis. A wildfire is burning in places that they, you know, never should, or never burning in places that they should.
Yeah, I mean, I ask you the question about the coming months because, I mean, we've been doing shows about this for so long, and people have been, you know, sounding the alarm bells. It's just, it's been so bad in terms of air quality and deaths and destruction. And so a lot of people wonder if this is the beginning of our fire season. What is to come in October and November?
Yeah, my heart goes out to those who are suffering. Some people have lost everything. They've lost loved ones. They've lost their homes. They've been uprooted. They're refugees. And the rest of us inundated with this pall of smoke that is hazardous to health and unhealthy. So my heart goes out to all those, and especially the firefighters who've been out on the line since early spring.
Right.
Toiling away under the worst of conditions, having their own, you know, fears about, the pandemic and still doing their duty. So in California, I mean, the worst may be yet to come. You know, traditionally, Southern California, its fire season really fires up in late fall. And so we'll see. You know, we're bracing for the worst, but hoping for the best.
How do you both explain where we are right now? Because you've got a number of factors, you know, the climate crisis, droughts, record heat, management, so much development in fire-prone areas and fire suppression. There are a lot of factors here, Don. How do you explain how we got to this place?
Yeah, it's a complex issue, and I'm glad that you point out all those different factors kind of coming together. I think the root of it really comes down to thinking of the shifts in attitudes and policies within the landscape of, particularly of the West. I mean, basically, if we think about indigenous stewardship from British Columbia all the way to Baja California, and east, you know, towards the Rockies and so forth, there's a long-standing tradition of indigenous burning. And when settlement occurred, you know, beginning with Spanish, you know, in the 1769 time period here in California, that really began to shift the way that practice of applying fire to the landscape really began to change. And so, you know, from 1769 forward, we see a shift in the type of fire that this landscape has evolved with, and that's really been the missing question or piece, the factor that drives it to allow it to be more resilient. You know, people have lived in many of these places that people are currently living, although not in the same densities, for thousands of years. And so, you know, the one tool that was at the discretion of those people was fire. And when we've removed that use of that tool from the landscape, that then doesn't allow for that landscape to correct and be resilient to environmental changes that are happening at that particular point in time, and the longer-term climate changes that have occurred, you know, cooler periods, wetter periods, drier periods, et cetera. We just haven't been able to do that. So this is really a big correction that nature is providing to us at this point.
And Dan, you were quoted in a piece from CAP Radio called "The Racist Removal of Native Americans in California is Often Missing from Wildfire Discussions." It seems like in the last week or so, there's been a lot more media coverage of this issue.
Yes, there's been a lot more media attention, particularly to the Indigenous Fire piece. And I think it's really wonderful to see that for a number of reasons. But really, when you get back to what I had just stated in terms of that process of Indigenous fire being part of the landscape, you know, when we think about trying to resolve the issue of wildland fire across, you know, various areas of the world, we often neglect the Indigenous stewardship that's taken place in those areas.
Right.
And we need to really be thinking about how successful those things were and how we can then reintegrate that in as process to those places. So that's mm-hmm. not just exclusive to the U.S., but listening to the BBC news piece just a bit ago, talking about the fires in the Pantanal and you know, fires in Australia and other places, you know, Indigenous people have relationships with fire in these areas, at least traditionally, and we really need to be thinking globally about how to support that. And I know that there's a lot of effort, you know, in different areas, including even in Europe, to think about how to integrate traditional uses of fire in those places.
Tim, what would you add?
Oh.
Do we have Tim?
Yes.
Okay, hi. What would
sorry,
you add, Tim?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Sure. So it seems like just reading articles and, you know, looking at social media, people want to grab onto one thing, you know, whether it's the climate crisis or land management, forest management, but there's many different factors. And, you know, Don was just talking about, you know, prior to the colonization of the West, Indigenous tribes burned around 4.5 million acres a year, and that is starting to get a lot more attention in the media.
It absolutely has, and it started even with the Australian fires.
Right.
You know, pointed out that the Indigenous people there, the Aborigines, had a relationship with fire and the land that, you know, sustained that their ecosystem, sustained their civilization, and then that was, it was basically thwarted, or in some cases perverted, and, you know, misapplication of that model. And, you know, some of the early settlers, by the way, actually did apply fire. Miners prospecting in California would torch up entire mountainsides, not with the kind of low-intensity spring burning that the native people used, but deliberate hot fires meant to expose, you know, the, you know, ore veins. You know, other farmers would burn forests off just to clear the land off, you know, and then and prepare for the plow. But then with the Forest Service, they adopted a kind of a, I guess, imperial model of state control and monopolization of fire management, excluding all the frontier fire people and especially the native fire use, and thus began kind of the fire exclusion regime, which even before they had the ability to really effectively suppress fire, they were attempting to exclude fire. And so the problem goes back further than just, effective fire suppression, which really wasn't that effective until post-World War II. It's the fires we failed to put in, as well as the fires we've, put out, that is part of the problem. And so we're at this moment, I think, globally, where we really should stop and compare the imperial versus the indigenous model of fire management. Mm-hmm. And what kind of lessons does society need to relearn about how to live with fire on the land?
There was a great article in The Conversation called "The World's Best Fire Management System is in Northern Australia, and it's led by Indigenous land managers." The piece says, "The tropical savannas of Northern Australia are among the most fire-prone regions in the world. On average, they account for 70% of the area affected by fire every year in Australia. But effective fire management over the past 20 years has reduced the annual average area burned, an area larger than Tasmania." And this is all led by Indigenous people. And it's really interesting because it's paid for. We can talk about that in a minute. But there's a video here. A number of Aboriginal people are interviewed talking about traditional Indigenous fire management. It involves deploying cool and patchy burning early in the dry season to reduce grass fuels. So I guess the question is, Don, now that this is getting more attention, what are some of the changes you would like to see? Because, we've heard about state agencies working with Indigenous leaders, but how widespread is that?
Yeah, well, that's a really good set of questions there. And I'll start with the how widespread it is first. I guess it's pretty, if we think about how many places it's actually happening in the state, there's really just a handful of areas where people are burning, and we see about that sometimes in some of the popular media pieces, up in the Klamath River, a little bit of work down on the San Mateo, Santa Cruz County coastline, a little bit of work up here in the area in the Lassen foothills and up in the Cascades and Sierras, and also a little bit in the Central Valley and then Southern Sierras. Those are really the places where it's mostly happening, but not at the scale that it would make a huge difference at this point, because of various barriers that are there, including, some of the policy restrictions, some of the things that are imposed by the agencies and lack of recognition of knowledge and trust and those sorts of things. And then funding and capacity are a really big part of that too. Mm-hmm. In a lot of situations, people aren't, they're not getting paid to do some of the work that they're doing. They're doing it out of a labor of love for the land and, carrying on traditions. And I think, getting into kind of thinking about, well, where and what opportunities do we have, that example you were talking about in Northern Australia is a really fantastic model in a lot of respects, particularly in the Arnhem Land region, which is east of Kakadu National Park, and I've done research in that region. The thing that's funding a lot of that is actually carbon abatement. So in California, we have AB 32 in the state that has, looked at the greenhouse gas emissions, and there's a lot of work that goes on around that. But the one difference, I think, is that in our state, we're not funding Indigenous people to go out or communities to be able to go out and do burning. A lot of times we're looking at afforestation-type projects and those sorts of things. But I think if we shifted policy to look more like the Indigenous examples in Australia with the West Arnhem Fire Abatement Program and carbon capture that's actually happening all across Australia, funding Indigenous people to go out and do burns, maintain biodiversity, reduce the fuel loads to mitigate for wildfires, that's where we can really start to see a change. But we have to begin to reconnect people to landscapes and scale up from there to get the kind of changes we need at the landscape scale. And it's Indigenous and non-Indigenous people working together. It's,
right.
There's not a large population of California Indians in the state, And so, you know, it's people working together and, you know, really kind of becoming citizens of the landscapes we live in. And I'm saying that inclusively of everyone, that if you live in a place, like, you should work with your local tribal people, you know, the traditional cultural practitioners in particular, who carry the knowledge and support them to achieve the work that needs to happen.
Yeah, according to this piece, it's Indigenous rangers working with park rangers and then also conservation groups. So I guess that's the big question, Tim, is how do you scale this up to the point where it actually makes a difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a huge difference is needed, and so little time given climate change and the rapid changes that flow from that. What we need above all, I think, is working models that can, you know, demonstrate success and inspire hope. And, you know, Don's mentioned, and you mentioned some places across the planet that offer these, but Don's right. What's lacking is the resources, you know, and so we're, you know, I'm most familiar with the work in Northern California amongst the Karuk, and you know what they need is you know more funding, more support, and it, you know we're at this moment. It's very special. I hope the wider society takes advantage of Indigenous people willing to share their knowledge, and you know willing to kind of lead. But it can't be just another, we'll rip off their techniques and throw away all the rest of that relationship with fire, you know, even a spiritual connection with fire and the land that's needed. So it's got to be some kind of a real genuine collaborative, you know, relationship that you know, hopefully will kind of, you know, offer some kind of reparations for the sins of the past.
Hmm.
And, it, you know, I mean, the smoke we're smelling right now, I mean, to some people, it is, you know, it's the smell of settler colonialism at work. And all these epic firefighting, you know, actions, you know, taking place on sacred grounds is yet another assault of the cavalry, if you will, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the opportunity is there. We just need to shift our focus and our priorities. All these billions and billions of dollars we're largely throwing away, in many cases on futile firefighting actions, you know, given to Indigenous peoples and communities that to fund like proactive fire management would do a lot to change the direction where we're headed.
That is Dr. Timothy Inglesby. Oh, go ahead, Don.
I was just going to follow up on that because I think what Tim was saying was really right on, and I'm not sure where we're at spending-wise on fire suppression this year and what the losses are, you know, in terms of cost for, like, infrastructure and so forth. But think about if we're – just take a number and say $50 billion that is spent. And I know last year in Australia they spent over $150 billion Australian in losses. You know, if we took even half that amount of money and applied it to Indigenous fire management in the state to do proactive work, that would be a tremendous boost to being able to do something. And I know that in Western Australia, they use roughly half of their budget for fire for doing proactive work, and that includes work within Indigenous communities for rangers to go out and burn and so forth. And they really don't see the kinds of fires that we're seeing. I mean, yeah, you get big fires from time to time, but they're just not seeing the same kinds of fires that we have because of being proactive with the use of that money. So, you know, if we invert it and we start using more money for the proactive work, we can get away from the losses and the destruction and, you know, just the wasting of resources.
Can you talk a little bit then about how money is dispersed? According to the LA Times, spending on suppression has increased to more than half of the Forest Service's budget, up from 15% a few years before. Can you give us some insights, Tim, onto how these decisions are made?
Well, the budget for managing fire, I'll just take the Forest Service, for example, divided into two main categories. One is fire preparedness, and to me that means planning for fire and, getting ready for fire. But the preparedness program has been steered into fire prevention, which is different from preparing for it. It's trying to avoid it. And you know, we've done that across the wider landscape, and it's caused significant harm. The other part of the budget is fire operations, which has been defined almost exclusively as suppression. And that's not really operating with fire in my mind. That's putting it out as quick as possible. And so we got the structure there for how to apply federal dollars. What's needed is a shift in philosophy, even a paradigm shift, in going from, really, we're still playing at fire control, fire exclusion, fire fighting. Fighting all fires at all places this season. We've got to shift to that mindset of working with fire instead of fighting against fire. Truly planning and preparing for fire instead of this futile effort of preventing all fires. And then whatever fires on the landscape, whatever source, whatever location, managing it somewhere. That might mean extinguishing it as soon as possible. It's threatening a town, put it out. In other places, it might mean, okay, working with time and space to maximize the ecological benefits of burning, but minimize the risk and hazards to people, the cost to taxpayers, and the impacts to the land itself from these aggressive suppression actions.
Let's talk a little bit, before we go to break, about prescribed burns and just what that would look like, especially at a time when there's been so much development in the state of California, especially in fire-prone areas. So, Don, how are you thinking today about what prescribed burns would actually look like?
Right. Well, I actually live in a community where we do a bit of prescribed burning, and I moved here because I wanted to kind of bring that into action, right? So, you know, as a landowner, I have the ability to burn on my property during the times of year when it's seasonally appropriate. And it starts at the house. You know, you know, for me, I burn away from the house, and I create zones where the fuel is reduced around that. And if, you know, if we can expand around that within, say, the wildland urban interface, where, you know, homes and infrastructure are within that forested environment, or other, you know, ecosystem environments, we can reduce the propagation of embers that are usually, you know, the primary cause for why structures burn down in the first place. So if we can reduce the amount of embers that are potentially coming in at some distance away from the homes, then it really reduces the likelihood that those homes are going to burn. And so, you know, we can strategize within the landscape of where the best places to do that are. You know, a lot of emphasis that we have in our region, because the north winds are one of the things in the north end of the north end of the Sierras and the Southern Cascades and the Sacramento Valley. The north winds during certain times of the year are really the main drivers for fire. And so, you know, if we kind of target taking care of those areas at the greatest risk to the communities and reduce the fuels in those places with prescribed burns and so forth, then that really helps to protect the communities from that. And we've been really successful in starting that. Again, it's not at the scale where it needs to be, but, you know, it's a starting point that hopefully at some point we'll get it to that landscape scale where it will make the difference down the road.
And Don, you're a professor at Chico State, which is right near Paradise. We've done so many shows about what happened in Paradise, and these are hard conversations to have, but, you know, a lot of people are wondering, should people be living in these areas?
Yeah, absolutely. And people, you know, I actually serve on our local Fire Safe Council as well, but, you know, the conversations around burning and the kind of things that you're asking people have always been, well, I don't know if we can do that in a town. Well, I'll tell you, after the campfire, people are now saying, Don, you're right, we need to be burning in the town of Paradise. We should be burning, and we need to do it sooner than later. Mm-hmm. So I'm really happy to see that. And I would say, you know, I'm also field director for our ecological reserves for campus, and 2 weeks after the campfire happened, we were doing prescribed burns on our ecological reserves to put a little bit of good fire smoke up in the air to get people to realize that, look, we have a choice to make, and we need to be using the opportunities that are presented to us to be able to put that fire there at the right times.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Don Hankins, pyrogeographer and professor of geography and planning at California State University at Chico. He's a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. Dr. Timothy Inglesby is executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. He started his career as a wildland firefighter for the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service, and he's a certified senior wildland fire ecologist. Today, we are talking about what it will take to change the way fires are managed. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about what it will take to change the way fires are managed. And if you have a question or a comment for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. Also, this is now starting to get more attention, just indigenous tribes burning around 4 million acres a year. So what are your thoughts about these prescribed burns and how they can happen? Just raising awareness really is so important to let people know how this works. Today, we're joined by Don Hankins, a professor of geography and planning at California State University at Chico. He's a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. Dr. Timothy Inglesby is executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, an organization that promotes safe fire management, working with fire instead of fighting against fires. Tim, what would you add when it comes to prescribed burns? It really is going to take a lot of public education just to let people know how this works.
Yes, and according to the various polls, you know, the public is coming along to that idea, maybe far ahead of what other, government officials assume. You know, they assume that this cartoon bear is all powerful and it's got everyone absolutely freaked out about all fire. The public is on board, and I think Don had a good example of the community of paradise. But there's just so many constraints on the ability to apply prescribed fire. Regulatory constraints, budgetary constraints, social cultural constraints. And, you know, the scale of the problem is so vast. So where I believe, you know, the progressive wing of the fire management community is at is kind of, you know, giving up on prescribed burning as going to solve the problem. And they're really looking to managing wildfires as light prescribed fires will really get us the amount and the kind of fire we really want to see on the land. So that would involve, you know, again, planning out for.
Tim, are you still with us? Oh, I think we're having some issues with Tim's line. Hopefully we'll reconnect with him.
Yeah, I can add one more thought, if
please.
You don't mind. Yeah, so, you know, one thing I think in terms of getting the public engaged, and this is kind of an approach that I personally like to take, is if we can put burns in places that people can see and walk through and interact with more frequently, that helps to build the knowledge base around it. So a lot of the burns that I've done have been in areas that are planned along like roadways and highways. Like one of the biggest ones that we did a couple years back was actually along Highway 99 in Sacramento County. And, you know, we burned off 100 acres in an oak woodland, and lots of people had to drive by that every day to see it. And I think, you know, that's a big part of the public awareness around it. So if we can put things kind of visually in a location, it's like a big billboard, like this is good fire coming to your neighborhood. Mm. That's one approach. And then I think just getting people comfortable with, you know, even being out there. And that's one thing that's a little bit more challenging is how do you get the public out to participate in these kind of burns? You know, and that's one of the regulatory agency, you know, kind of limitations is they're very strict about who can be around the active fire. But I think if people can be interactive with it, it helps to build that comfort and culture to accept it. And so I think if people can feel that they're a little bit more in control and see how it can be controlled, that will also help to get more people on board with the idea too.
Well, and it seems like now we just need to do some educating, because what we're doing now is just devastating. I mean, every single person has been affected by this.
Yeah.
You know, even people who live in cities that don't actually have fires.
Yeah, absolutely. People are affected in many different ways, and there's a lot of triggers that come from the fires. And I know that, even lighting a barbecue in my neighborhood at this point, you know, people will say, you know, start, you know, chatting through social media, is there a fire somewhere? Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, it's unfortunate, mainly because of the campfire, that people have that response. But you know, we have to also recognize that at certain times of the year, we need to have that smoke that's there representing the good fires. And I think that's one thing I'll come back to, thinking about, you know, one of the things that distinguishes indigenous fires from the kinds of fires that we're seeing. And you've mentioned, you know, the 4.5 million acres example. You know, that's a pretty conservative estimate, by the way, in terms of how much would have been burned in pre-contact times. But you know, in the state of California, we're probably pushing about 3.2 million acres burned this season. And, you know, to put it in context, if we think about that 4.5 million as a conservative estimate for the state, people might be wondering, well, when was that happening and how much smoke was in the air? One thing that's really important to think about is how people were burning throughout the year. They were setting fires in different ecosystems for different cultural and ecological outcomes to come from those places. So, you know, you might think about burning in a vernal pool or wetland ecosystem in the fall, maybe, and then you're moving into the oak woodlands in the early part of the winter, and then, you know, the conifer forest in that same time frame. And if you think about the rotation of those fires throughout the whole entirety of California's ecosystems and landscapes, that's a little bit of fire and smoke that's coming up throughout the seasons, but when you take the total accumulation of that, it's a large amount of land that's treated.
And a point you made in the CAP Radio piece, Don, is that if the landscape of California was still stewarded continuously with indigenous fire, we would definitely not see the same level of fires that we're seeing today.
Yes, we would see fire. I mean, it's not that magically fire would disappear. Fire is always going to be here, and I think that's really important for people to understand. You know, the difference is that the behavior of those fires is going to be totally different. So, you know, when what we know and what we should expect is that from, you know, in past climate events, you know, that indigenous people were living with, fires were bigger during longer prolonged drought time periods, for instance, and then in the wetter times, those fires were a lot smaller, and it really just, you know, relates to the amount of water that's within the landscape. By bigger, I'm saying, you know, maybe it increases from 100 acres to 1,000 acres, you know, that's being burned, but certainly not getting into, you know, the types of fires that we see today where we're going several hundred thousand acres or bigger, you know. That's the difference.
Right. And we talked about funding. Tim, what other policy changes would be needed to bring this up to scale?
Well, where we're at this year, I think, is very, very dangerous because of concerns about the spread of COVID. The U.S. Forest Service kind of resurrected its fight all fires policy that goes back to the 1930s. We call it the 10-AM policy. With the, you know, best of intentions, try to eliminate smoke impacting communities. Well, that smoke is impacting firefighters. You know, they've got their lungs on the line. But, you know, we've tried that, and we're successful throughout much of the spring. In fact, it was quite a mellow fire season in much of the West until it wasn't. And it was recognized that this attack all fires policy is not sustainable, but we just need to do it this year during the COVID crisis. Well, we're going to have that coronavirus with us next year, and we're going to have climate change with us next year and for generations to come. This, you know, temporary step backwards is on a slippery slope headed to a cliff, in my opinion. And it just feeds right in this kind of Western Enlightenment tradition of trying to control and conquer nature. Mm-hmm. And we just got to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be eternally, annually at war with nature? And we just have to shift that paradigm. Think about, you know, how did indigenous people survive? How did the forest survive? I live in the Willamette Valley where lightning is rare, but it was largely a grassland ecosystem maintained by the Kalapuya, who burns sometimes three times a year in different places for specific purposes. They lived with fire for 10,000 years, and they didn't own any fire engines or air tankers or any of that stuff. You know, so just really, you know, I hope this year is a real teachable moment and where we kind of hit the reset button on our whole narrative and relationship with fire and get out of this combat mode and start getting in a more coexistence mentality.
Well, let's take a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Boy, I hope I can take these off really quickly. First of all, I'm in agreement with a lot of what's been said, but there's a couple of things I wanted to bring up. One, there's 40 million people now living in the state of California. It's not the same as it was when the native people lived here, you know, in tribes, and there weren't that many people. Also, there are 200 million dead trees up in the Sierras. I don't know how you deal with that. Plus, you've got a lot of the land, which I just found out recently, is federally owned. So I don't know how the state's going to work with the feds to try and deal with that. Secondly, the Australians, even though they may be doing prescribed burns, had huge wildfires last summer, if you remember. So I don't know what was going on there. Maybe they mismanaged what was going on with their forest the same way we are. And I guess, lastly, well, I think I mentioned the drought. That's going to continue to go on. We're going to have climate change from now until the end of time. So I don't know how we're going to deal with this going forward. And I think, you know, it just one last thing. It just makes me wonder, and I'm not going to try and throw blame on anybody with regard to this, but this has been sort of neglected, obviously, for decades, if not longer, with regard to trying to deal with this in a different way. I'm hoping that you're right, that maybe going forward we might be able to change this, but this is like a tsunami that's just been waiting to occur, and everything has sort of come together at one point with all of this. So thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Just to your question about Australia, we'll add this article to yourcallradio.org. Indigenous people were working in the north, and according to this piece, northern Australia did not see the scale of destruction experienced in southern Australia, and a number of experts say that is because of Indigenous practices. Do you want to take some of the other points that Greg said first, Don?
Sure. Yeah, and I appreciate that you brought that up about Northern Australia too, because you know the population of Indigenous people in Northern Australia is a lot higher than it is in the South, and they're a lot freer to burn up there. The regulations are totally different in those regions than they are in the South, in the more populated areas and more European areas of Australia, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's really important to kind of think about, and I appreciate you know recognizing there's 40 million people living in the state. 25 million of those people live roughly from, you know, the L.A. basin to the U.S.-Mexico border in very densely urbanized areas that, you know, we think about the Bay Area, we think about these clusters, you know, in the Sacramento Valley. Those are the population areas. But there are also opportunities to burn in those places. And you know, thinking about the Bay Area audience there in particular, you know, the Santa Cruz Mountains is a place where fire should be, and we should be stewarding, say, San Francisco watershed lands with fire to reduce the fuel loads, to enhance the healthy ecosystems that are there, and improve water quality, among other things. So it's definitely possible. I mean, I think one thing that folks might recall is thinking about the fires that happened in San Bruno not too many years back that happened from the PG&E gas line explosion. But, you know, like, when that happened, I was thinking, well, San Bruno is a wildland urban interface community. What could be done differently about fire in that particular landscape? So we need to be thinking about that. We can't just steer away from the idea that fire doesn't belong in those particular places, the East Bay Hills, Marin County, et cetera. They're all places where fire should be, and we need to be thinking about how to safely and effectively use it in those places. And it can be done. We just need to get the buy-in from people to be able to do that. As far as the drought piece and the dead trees in the Sierras, that's definitely a matter of correction. And I think the opportunity that's there, and I kind of conceptualize around this, is that if we can run fire through some of these places where we have tree die-offs, rather than having those trees fall down and rotting and that carbon that's been stored in those trees as green carbon now is being released back into the atmosphere as part of the CO2, if we can actually run fire around them and create the char, you know, biochar around these trees and actually have them as black carbon within the environment, that's going to be stable in the environment for tens of thousands of years, if not longer. And so by doing that, then we are capturing carbon. We're taking that CO2 out of the environment and putting it back into that fossil fuel source, if you want to think about it that way, to be able to minimize that impact. And so that's something that I think is important to think about as an opportunity.
Hmm. Tim, what would you add?
Well, on that tree situation, I mean, it is counterintuitive, but fire really spreads to the fine, small diameter fuels, mostly on the surface. The most flammable trees, part of a tree is its needle mass, and a dead snag doesn't have any of it. So fire doesn't really leap from large snag to large snag. Fire is actually nature's great recycler. And some of that dead down material should be recycled back into soil nutrients, and fire does that great. This big push by California and its timber industry to just get and log out all those big trees, so they fuel big wildfires. Well, the scale is so vast. They're just going to be cherry picking what's the most profitable trees to haul out. Those just happen to be the most valuable trees for the ecosystem, for wildlife, for the watershed stability, for soil, and Don, as Don pointed, carbon storage. So, getting fire in some of these areas, even in some areas where machines and people really can't roam, safely, important. Hello?
Hi, Tim, you're still there. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, there's been some communications breakdowns. Maybe a fire has burned down a cell tower at some way here. So, 40 million people live in state of California, and just about every one of them, not by choice, is hooked into a system of burning fossil fuels. And though, the smoke columns from wildfires are real evident, and it's like, oh my God, those carbon-spewing wildfires, that invisible carbon pollution from burning fossil fuels is the real, real crisis we got to deal with. So there should never be another power line ignited wildfire in the state of California with such potential for rooftop solar. And I just don't know of any wildfire that's been ignited from a rooftop solar panel. Hmm. And so there's a lot that those 40 million people can do to avoid the wrong kinds of human-caused fire from power lines and arsonists and other things, and then help encourage the right kinds of human-caused fire. And there's the example of Don. He does it on his own land, right near his own home. We should be emulating that. Those are success stories. I would love the news media to start featuring. Instead of the homes that are incinerated by wildfires, what about the homes that are sustained by the strive fires? And so if we break down this kind of monopolization of fire by government agencies and get communities actually involved directly, maybe even just observing describe burns. I have described burns on the edge of my town as well, in the city parks. So it's going to remove some of that mystique, some of that socially conditioned fear of fire. I think that'll get us a long way there in terms of relearning how to live with fire.
And since you brought that up, Tim, I have to ask you, since Donald Trump is, I don't even know what word to use. I don't want to say downplaying climate. I mean, the guy basically said it's going to get cooler. It's just ridiculous to even go there. But he says California must thin the forests. And, this is getting a lot of attention, and a lot of people are now saying the solution here is to thin the forest. What is your response to that?
Well, yes, thin the forest with fire. Because, again, what carries fire, and the real issue now is this rapid rate of spread that is, overwhelming firefighters and dropping through towns ahead of even evacuation notices. The rapid, extremely rapid rate of spread is spread by embers that hopscotch across the land, and they land and ignite small, fine diameter fuels. I mean, when Trump says we got to make America rake again, It is the fine diameter surface fuels that really carry fire spread, rapid fire spread, and only fire is going to do that. There's nothing like fire to affect fire. Logging won't remove dead bats of needles, grazing and all that other stuff that we try. There just is no mechanical or chemical substitute for all the good things that fire does, including reducing the generally hazardous fuels that carry fire spread. So thin the fuels with fire, I'd get behind that for sure. Thinning with logging, just taking the opposite, you know? Because in general, logging removes the biggest trees and leaves behind the smallest trees, and fire tends to do the opposite.
Yeah.
Take the smallest and leaves the biggest.
And I want to ask you both quickly about, you know, human-caused fires. We had a fire ecologist, Chris Dykus, on our show last week, and he said almost 90% of wildfires are caused by people or human action. The El Dorado fire is getting international attention. It was caused by pyrotechnics at a gender reveal party. Now, arsonists, obviously, it's difficult to do anything about that. But humans having pyrotechnics at a party, that cannot happen. And then, other accidents caused by humans. It seems, Don, that like a public service announcement needs to be put out there so people know that a lot of these fires are caused by human activity.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of awareness that goes out there. I think a lot of people don't think about they don't have the common sense to think about what, you know, that device that they're using might cause. You know, when we think about, you know, a lot of the starts, it's, you know, chains dragging along highways, like, or a tire, you know, failing as, you know, started the car fire, for instance, 2 years, you know, back in Reading area. We tend not to think about, you know, reading the landscape and knowing, like, oh, you know, the grass is starting to dry out. Maybe I shouldn't be setting off, fireworks right now. Mm-hmm. Those are some basic things that I think people need to be aware of. But I think that there's always a lot of effort that goes into that, and people still do it. So that's a challenging thing to try to deal with.
Hmm. And then also I want to ask you both about the politics around this. I mean, California is run by Democrats. They have a supermajority in Sacramento. Tim, if we can just talk at the state level, what will it take to change policies?
Well, it'll take legislators listening to their voters more than their donors, I believe. And a lot of our politics is just, it's legal corruption. The amount of influence that big money donors can wield over legislators, and the things that I think what the citizens of California are crying out for is the ability to feel safe in their own homes. Their lives will be protected. Their property will be protected. So that should be the focus. The wildfire crisis is, you know, the dominant image of wildfires are burning buildings and incinerated communities. And so all this money, though, is headed towards, commercial logging or commercial thinning or doing this or that in the backcountry. Mm-hmm. Or let's ramp up and build bigger air force of air tankers and helicopters. I mean, let's focus on preparing and protecting communities first. And once we do that, it will open up a lot more options of how we deal with fire on the land. So that's got to come from the people themselves demanding that their tax dollars really focus on their highest priorities, their highest values, their highest needs, instead of just more, you know, corporate welfare, funding, you know, industries' attempts to use wildfire crisis to further their own, you know, their own agenda. That's my opinion.
Don, what would you add?
Well, I think about it in this way. One is that, you know, in the area where Chico is located in Butte County, our representatives are all Republican. We're kind of a difference from a lot of the major metropolitan areas of the state where it's mostly Democratic. I think, you know, one of the things that's really important is for people to work together. You know, there's a lot of political division that takes place. The climate change issue is obviously one of those big pieces. And I think that if people work together and realize, you know, that what the issues are and stop politicizing it, then we have a better opportunity to advance things. And so, you know, I'm happy that there's a few folks that are running for assembly within this region, and even in San Francisco, one of the Senate, candidates is looking at, how to incorporate indigenous fire back into the landscape. You know, and so we've got representatives in this area who have come forward and said, you know, hey, how can we change this and so forth. I think there's still a lot of politics that takes place, like Tim was referring to, around industry stepping in and saying, you know, oh, we need to have more logging and this and that. But I think if we really look at the issues and we can all work together and rely on not only information from the constituents, but also, you know, I would say, you know, if our policymakers are not educated about these issues themselves, they should be reaching out to people like myself and others who have the knowledge to be able to make sensible policies within our state and hopefully, you know, really be able to have some major change for the positive for all of us.
Don Hankins is professor of geography and planning at California State University at Chico. He's a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. Dr. Timothy Inglesby is executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. Thank you both so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Don was talking about Jackie Fielder, who is running for state senate in San Francisco, and she has an indigenous wildfire plan that she put together. We are actually trying to put together a debate between Jackie Fielder and Scott Weiner. So far, Jackie Fielder has agreed, Scott Weiner has not, so we will continue to work on that so we can talk about these very important issues. You can find more information about today's show at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.